and beta.
Here's Johnny.
Don't you get it? You gotta use reverse psychology. That sounds too complicated. Okay, don't use reverse psychology. All right, I will.
You got a big head.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta. Today, Kevin Nealon. He is best known for his stellar work on Saturday Night Live, his stand-up comedy, and his appearances in several Adam Sandler movies. But Kevin is also a very talented caricature artist.
Wherever I go now, I feel like I'm in a funhouse, you know, mirrors, because everybody that walks by me, I see their exaggerated features and their how I would draw them.
We'll hear more from Kevin a little bit later. Also, author Elise Knorr takes us behind the scenes of what it takes to create one of the most successful video games of its generation. It's a game inspired by the cinematic universe of
Bond. James Bond.
There were some really funny, silly things, sort of irreverent things. You can turn on big head feature in multiplayer and all your players have big heads, or you can shoot paintball.
But first, George Saunders. Time magazine has described him as the best short story writer in English. I'm willing to bet he's one of the best short story writers in any language. George's latest collection is called Liberation Day. It's his first in nearly a decade, since the critically acclaimed collection 10th of December. Is it possible that George's latest short story collection finds his writing even more suitably Saunders-esque than his previous one? Yes, it is, dear listener. Yes, it is. There's something very special about a George Saunders story. There's his trademark humor, his love and respect for humanity, and the kindness and tremendous empathy that he shows for his reader. He joined us from his home in California to talk about the collection and why he titled it Liberation Day.
At the end of a book of stories, I just look at all the titles of the individual stories, and the assumption is that one of those will be the book title. What I'll do is I'll kind of put each of the stories on a separate index card and put them on the kitchen counter and kind of just think through it with that, you know, proposed title in mind. And when I got to Liberation Day, something kind of sparked, because I think in every one of the stories, there's somebody who is kind of fed up with the way things have always been for him or for her and wants to make that big change, you know, that one we all long for, after which we'll be completely happy and high functioning and not neurotic. And so in each of the story, there's some kind of resolution to fix things once and for all. Mostly those don't go that well because we're human beings. But what I'll do is I'll have the title in mind, kind of scan each story and see if there's any relation at all between the book title and the story. And there's just a little click I feel like, oh yeah, that's speaking to that. So it's all, you know, like my whole process is very intuitive. And the assumption is if I can go through it and keep changing things until I like it more, then the whole project will be saying more in the end.
Mm-hmm. And I think that the assumption is right. Your editor, Andy Ward, says that Liberation Day is yet another step forward in your evolution as a writer. How do you think your work has evolved over, say, the last 10 years?
Well, I think, you know, I suppose as you get older, you become a little more confident in your view of things. You know, you've sort of lived through pretty much all there is to live through. So I guess I feel like, well, if things feel a certain way to me, there must be some validity to that. And more importantly, you probably have felt it too. You know, in other words, I think as I'm getting older, I'm feeling more convinced that people are quite capable of communicating about the deep things, that all the kind of superficial things that divide us really are real and they're true and they have to be dealt with. But under there's a quality of something. I would call it humanity, really. So if I'm more confident that if I speak to that part of you will rise to meet me. And it's just kind of a quiet confidence from, you know, tens of thousands of interactions with people. Whereas when I was younger, I think I wasn't so sure that. And so there's a slightly defensive thing you do as a younger writer, which is to be really smart, fast, funny, cynical, you know, which all those things have their value. But I think they also tend to be sort of like moves to keep the reader at bay, as opposed to the moves I'm trying to do now, which are to embrace the reader and say, yeah, you know, it's like that for me too.
Hmm. Yeah. You've said in the past that the basic idea of a short story collection is in line with your view of the world. So how do you think Liberation Day reflects your worldview at this moment?
Yeah. Well, you know, it was written during the whole, you know, this last 5 or 6 years mostly. The way I feel about it is when you're writing short stories, they don't take 7 years to write one story. Or they shouldn't. Sometimes they do, but theoretically they're quicker than that. So in a sense, what you're doing is you're kind of saying to yourself, okay, how do you feel during this period? Let's make up a situation, even a really silly one, and let's just live in it day after day after day with a lot of concentration, and let's see which part of you that story represents. Okay, then you do that. Then you finish that, and when you turn to another one, how do I feel now? And you do it again. And so by the time you've done 9 of these, it's a pretty good kind of maybe slightly distorted or exaggerated snapshot of where your mind was during those years. And the thing that I love about it and that intrigues me so much is it's not really a snapshot that I would have predicted. If you ask me now, write a short essay on how you feel, you know, it would be certain things would come out. But in the stories, they come out in these crazy ways that are somehow more truthful than the story I can tell myself about how I feel. You know, it's almost like a self-revelation or something. And I think that just comes from the fact that you're focusing so hard and you're allowing your subconscious to come out in these focused periods that you even surprise yourself. I love that so much about the form.
Mm, yeah. Of course, I could be wrong about this, but I think that the story Love Letter gives us a really good sense of where your mind is at these days. Can you tell us about it?
If you sort of think there's the surface mind and the deeper mind, that story is very much where my surface mind has been. It's just really a kind of a letter from a very loving grandfather to his probably 20-year-old grandson. Things have gotten worse. There's a kind of a vague dictatorship in place in the country, right-wing dictatorship. And this grandfather has been, we feel he's been chided by the grandson in a previous letter for not doing more, for being kind of passive and having his head in the sand. So this letter is the grandfather's response in which he very gently tries to explain to his grandson how this terrible change in American politics happened sort of on his watch. A lot of my feelings, this is sort of written just before the last election, a lot of my feelings about myself were in that story. You know, why am I not doing more? Why do I not know what to do? Why is it that whenever I try to do something, it seems to have no effect? Are we really going to let our democracy sink into the muck with this little feeling about it? So that was the beginning of the story. You put that in there, you know, then again, because it's only part of my feelings, then I just attribute it to this grandfather, who's not me. And then the story starts to distinguish him and starts to kind of attest him, I think, a little bit, you know. So, but yeah, that story is, I mean, there are things that are right out of my life in there, which I don't usually do. And it felt really nice, you know, to kind of say, I'm anxious, here it is, you know, and send it to the New Yorker and say, does this connect with anybody over there?
Mm-hmm. And if I'm not mistaken, you had intuition about the grandfather. You knew the kind of voice you wanted to use for the grandfather, but you weren't sure what the grandfather should do in the story. So how did you deal with that?
You know, one of the things I do when I'm writing is you put something out, and I'm a real obsessive rewriter, so I come back and read it again and again and again. And what will happen is as you're reading it, you'll notice a chink in his armor, the character's armor. So the character is asserting one thing, but under there, you might detect a little uncertainty. And that's where you kind of dig in. So with this guy, he pretty confidently explains, almost elegiacally, well, yes, this is how we lost our democracy. And maybe it's not that important, actually. Maybe we just have to, you know, enjoy our lives and so on. But I started noticing little kind of almost like verbal tells or ticks that he was protesting too much. So then you start to lean into that and you say, okay, wait a minute, this guy is saying these confident things, but behind there, he's got a doubt. Why? And then you start sort of urging the story in the direction that will test him. So in the story, he finds out that his grandson is, about to do something a little bold and a little against the law and a little rebellious. And he's against that. But then as he starts to kind of piece the thing together in his mind, he sees that the grandson is trying actually to rescue the woman he loves from the clutches of this dictatorship. I think in the last few paragraphs, just lightly, you feel him getting, the grandfather getting really wobbly about his views suddenly. So the story he's told himself for probably 10, 15 years under the pressure of his love for his grandson starts to crack a little bit. And by the end, he's sort of tentatively offering to fund this venture, maybe, we feel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very well said. It's a very powerful story. Let's talk about the title story, Liberation Day. It's set in the near future, and it deals with a revolutionary new way of presenting history, if I can put it that way. Where did this story come from?
Oh boy, that's a, you know, that it's a weird one. And I, here's how I think about it. I try to get some little nugget of an idea that just is interesting to me and almost like will create a kind of ornery fun. So I start with that. And then the real challenge is to take that kind of playful idea and gradually over many months of rewriting it, cause it to say something that will speak to you, my reader. I feel like you're going to start off by saying, wow, this is weird. How do you think of this? And hopefully by the end of it, it's speaking to you about something that matters to you. And I don't think we even have to necessarily be able to name it. But so almost by definition, if you stick with this weird thing, you know, in spite of your impulses along the way to bail because it's too weird, if you stick with it, you know, then it means that you're engaged, you know, you're in connection with it. So for me, that's the really the high level challenge. Start with a crazy idea. In this case, it's just the idea that we're in the future and the technology has arrived such that we can take people, and I think the implication is they're people who are in trouble or poor or sick, and we make a deal with them in which we take all of the content of their brain out in order to make room for something else we're going to put in. In the case of our character, he's programmed basically to speak at a really high level about any topic you give him. So that was the first notion. And really, it was just because I wanted to get the chance to make somebody talk funny, to me, to be honest. You know, that's so much of it. So then it kind of went from there, you know, and even as I was writing, I'm like, this is some really crazy stuff. And okay, and then the job is to make it crazy, but at the same time, not random, to make sure that these people in the story, although they've been created at a weird offset to reality, that they still behave like human beings. And the assumption is in that process, we're going to find out something about human beings that we might not find out if we were just telling a regular story. The exaggeration is somehow key to producing a certain meaning.
Yeah. There's a story in Liberation Day, a story called Ghoul, which takes place in part of an underground theme park in Colorado in a very hellish area, literally. Can you tell us a bit about this story?
I got a chance to record my first book, Civil War Land and Bad Decline, on audiobook that had never been recorded. So I came out to LA and read it. And I think at first I thought, oh, you know, this is an old book and it'll be kind of weird and I won't like it. And I just really did like it. I enjoyed doing that voice again. The story is in a very strange kind of really truncated first person voice, and enjoyed it so much. I thought, you know, I wonder if I can still do that voice. So I came home and just gave myself the job of trying to write in that voice for a few pages. You know, in that mode, you really, at least for me, I'm really trying not to over control the topic. I'm just typing, you know, typing, and my energy is on the sound of the voice, and I don't really care what it's saying. So when I had done that, trying to sound like this earlier book, there was this guy who was, it might also have been Halloween, so he's a ghoul, you know, in kind of like a haunted house kind of thing. So, you know, you type up that, and I revise it and revise it again for sound. And then at some point you go, huh, that's pretty good writing. I like that. It's funny. And then you start to try to figure out what the heck is going on. Because you've made a big mess at that point. You've got an underground theme park that's called Maws of Hell. You've got this guy whose job is to squat all day playing a ghoul. You know, it's kind of irrational, obviously. So then the job becomes, okay, I've said all this stuff. I like the way it sounds. Now let me build the rest of the world around it. But the hope is that at the end of that, it's somehow, you know, the reader doesn't go, that is so weird, it's irrelevant to me. But instead goes, huh, why am I moved by this? Why have I had a wild ride caused by this weirdness? Yeah.
There's a story called Sparrow, which has a very different origin story from most of your stories. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, we were in our house that we used to have in New York State during one of the long winters of the pandemic. And I've been writing, I think I was writing Liberation Day, actually, at the time, the story. And I just woke up one night having had this vivid, vivid dream of a certain voice in my head. There was no dream except the voice. It was just this. And it was something like the first five or six lines of that story, Sparrow. And writers who have dreams, you wake up and you think, that's probably not a story. But in the light of the day, that's going to be dumb. So just forget it. But on this occasion, there was something about it that just, you know, I tried to go back to sleep and that voice kept hearing it or kept doing it in my semi-sleep. So finally, I just said, oh, all right. And I got up and went into the kitchen and turned the computer on and didn't have my glasses. It was kind of dark. But I just typed a whole first draft of that story, which I never do. That's completely unheard of for me. And I thought, well, this probably is no good. And tomorrow I'll throw it away. But when I printed out the next day and read it, it actually was, you know, okay. Then, you know, of course, I revised it for months afterwards. But there's something about that first impulse that was really powerful. It came out pretty much as it is.
In your Story Club with George Saunders Substack, you say that at this moment, we seem to be suffering from a widespread failure of literary imagination. How so?
When I say literary imagination, what I mean is this process we've been talking about, where we might start with a certain too simple version of another person or another group of people. And that is certainly the kind of information we get from most of our quick media, you know, from social media and from, especially from partisan media. I think we get, you know, kind of a placeholder for a certain kind of a person. And that's, it's useful. But then the literary imagination says, okay, you know, sure, I'll accept that. But can we poke at it a little bit? Can we look at it from a different angle? Is there anything about that person that maybe is missing in that simple description? It's also a way of thinking that recognize that we're always projecting about other people and that those projections are always too simple. You know, if I say somebody is a snooty law school professor, well, he probably is. Mm-hmm. But as we say, okay, well, sure, I accept that, but what else is he? Or even saying, can you tell me what exactly you mean by snooty? Can you give me an example? And somebody has to come up with an actual incident in which snootiness occurred. And once that happens, you can sometimes see, oh, you know, what I'm reading as snooty or snobby has an element of, for example, insecurity in it. You know, those kind of things. So the literary imagination is always saying, how so? And can you tell me more? And it's based on the idea that we can abide with people more deeply and longer than we think we can. And the story, reading and writing a story, is a way of just practicing that and maybe reassuring ourselves that we're actually pretty good at that. We're actually pretty good at sitting across the table from somebody with who we might have some disagreements and saying, well, how so? You know, can you tell me more mm-hmm. about that? Why do you feel that way?
Mm-hmm. Very well said. George Saunders, thank you very much for joining us. Congratulations on Liberation Day. We can't wait to read your next book as soon as possible, but no pressure.
Yeah, there's always pressure. No, thank you so much for having me. It's always great to talk to you.
George Saunders is the author of the short story collection, Liberation Day. Find out more about George and his work at WPR.org/beta.
That was the highlight of my career to this date, more so than Saturday Night Live or Weeds or any Adam Sandler film or, you know, whatever I've done.
That's Kevin Nealon. And spoiler alert, the highlight of his career is not his conversation with Beta. Find out what it is in just a moment. He joins us next on Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi. I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Kevin Nealon spent 9 years as a cast member of Saturday Night Live. During his time working live from New York, he played such characters as Mr. Subliminal, enjoyed him immensely, the Austrian muscle man Franz, who was ready to pump you up, very Arnold-esque, and Mr. No Depth Perception. Should have stopped doing the Subliminal bit after Mr. Subliminal. He's also a very successful stand-up comedian, and he's acted in Adam Sandler movies and on the Showtime series Weeds. But Kevin is also a very talented caricature artist. His new book, I Exaggerate, My Brushes with Fame, is filled with caricatures of celebrities and friends. People like Carrie Fisher, my fellow Canadian Jim Carrey, and my other fellow Canadian, Norm Macdonald. Kevin shares a story for every caricature and why he was inspired to create it. He joins us now to share some of these stories and to let us know when he found the itch to draw.
I became interested in drawing when I was about 8 years old. I saw a sketch that someone had did on a napkin at a cafe, and they left it on the table. It was just a simple face, like a big nose and a hat and a big chin and puffy collagen-type lips. And I was so amused by that, and I kept drawing it myself. You know, I wouldn't trace it, but I was copying it. And for some reason, that stuck in my head. And ever since then, I just started drawing and started drawing, doodling a lot, but never kind of committed to it like I am now. But I think I learned how to draw basically from drawing maps in school, because I didn't trace those. I just had to draw them, hand-eye coordination. And then I used to love Mad Magazine. I saw the caricatures in there by Mort Drucker. and I loved Al Hirschfeld. And I had two caricatures of my parents hanging on the wall in my bedroom, each one separately framed, that a Parisian caricature artist did. And they were amazing. I've never seen anything that great. And every night I'd lay down and I look at those things. I think subconsciously I was studying them and, you know, looking at how he exaggerated everything. So, you know, it's throughout my life I've been drawing these things. And then as I got older, I started drawing a little bit better. And then I was on airplanes going from gig to gig, and I started drawing people that were sleeping on the plane. Those are, some of those are in my book. And then during the table reads at SNL, if I wasn't in a sketch, I would start drawing other cast members in the margin of my script. And then a couple years ago, I was following these artists, these illustrators on Instagram. And I liked this one particular guy's work, and I noticed he was giving lessons. So I signed up for 10 lessons from him, and I Skyped with him in England.
Yeah. And if I'm not mistaken, you have actually posted some of your caricatures, and in the book, all the caricatures are of famous people, but you actually posted some on social media, and you've never got a response from anybody?
Well, yeah, I've never, I got responses from a lot of people, how much they loved it. That's why I continued to do it. But I never really heard back from anybody I sketched or did a painting of, maybe because they didn't follow me, or until recently I started hearing back from people. You know, Letterman loved his, Brad Paisley loved his, the Farley Camp liked his, Dana Carvey. I mean, there's just like one or two that were a little sensitive about it. And there was one that where they said, under no terms can you use this photograph promoting your book. So,
And I suspect you don't want to reveal who those people were. Right?
I mean, that's my biggest nightmare because I hate confrontation. I hate to make waves. Mm. And so when I hear that somebody doesn't like it, my skin is pretty thick from doing stand-up over the years, but still it took a little chip out of me.
Yeah, I can imagine it would. I have to admit that in some of our show meetings, I occasionally will doodle, and I have a history of doing that for a while, going back probably to even like around your age too, about being 8 years old. But I have never drawn a caricature of a colleague, and your book includes several caricatures of colleagues. Can you walk us through how you go about creating a caricature?
First, I select the character I want to draw, and it could be someone who interests me or someone who has an interesting face or a great reference photo that I found that is the lighting is correct and shows the features well. So that's where I start. Now, I do a lot of these on digital tablet. You know, it's digital artwork, multimedia. I add some paint to it later. And I'm not sure what the actual correct way to do this is, but for me, I start with a very loose sketch of the face. I kind of exaggerate it. The next thing is the eyes. I like to get the eyes first because they're kind of indicative of the rest of the face, because I do think you see the soul in people's eyes. From there, I just try to pick the features that are the most outstanding, you know, that are a little exaggerated to begin with, and then I just push that and make them more exaggerated.
Yeah. And you say that there's a downside to doing caricatures.
Yeah. Since I've been trained now to look at those outstanding features, wherever I go now, I feel like I'm in a funhouse, you know, mirrors, because everybody that walks by me, I see their exaggerated features and their how I would draw them. And it's, you know, it's a little scary.
Yeah, I can imagine it would be. One of your caricatures is of Johnny Carson, and you have a great story to go along with it. That's something worth pointing out, that you have stories about your meeting encounters with the subjects of your caricatures. Can you share the Johnny Carson Tonight Show story with us?
Oh, my God. I did the Tonight Show, which was my goal as a stand-up comic. That was the bar. If you could do the Tonight Show, it kind of validated you as a stand-up. I remember passing the audition at one of the clubs, and I was so excited. When it came time to actually do it, I was behind the curtain and they introduced me.
Would you welcome Kevin Nealon? Kevin.
And I came out to a rousing round of applause, and Johnny Carson was all over my right with Ed McMahon. And as I was walking out to my mark on the shiny black floor, I forgot my act. I could not even think of my act. And I got to my spot and the audience was still applauding and I'm still forgetting. And when the last clap ended, thank God I remembered my starting point.
Thank you very much. You know, I didn't always want to be a comedian. I remember a long time ago I wanted to be a veterinarian. What happened was this baby bird fell out of the tree. You know, and I brought him in the house and I nursed him back to health. And I remember for about a month after that, my nipples were really sore, you know?
It was just such a dream come true for me. And then I got paneled with Johnny, which was a very rare thing for a comic on their first outing. So that was, like I said, that was the highlight of my career to this date, more so than Saturday Night Live or Weeds or any Adam Sandler film or, you know, whatever I've done.
What would you do back in Connecticut?
I just, you know, I've been traveling around a lot, and I just enjoy that now. I wouldn't even think about going back,
yeah.
You know, for longer than 6-7 years, you know. But traveling is fun, but, you know, it gets lonely sometimes.
Sure.
You're on the road, you stay in these hotels, and you don't know anybody or anything. I used to call my girlfriend on weekends, but that didn't work out. And they say calling long distance is the next best thing of being there, right?
And it wasn't,
I say the next best thing of being there is being with someone that looks similar.
And he threw his head back and he laughed, and a little of that smoke still came out of his mouth from the commercial break. And that's what I depicted in the caricature of him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's a great caricature. And that's a great joke, too. Yeah. Well, one of my favorites, I like them all. Like, I can find something to like and love in all of your caricatures. But one of my favorites is your caricature of Tilda Swinton. Why did you decide to do a caricature of her?
Well, like I said, some of my choices come about from looking at reference pictures. And I saw amazing reference picture of her that was done from some Parisian stylist or something, or photographer. And it was such a great photograph of her and makeup and with kind of a look like her neck was a little long. So I did that. And it was one of my favorite caricatures. But then when we went to get approval from the photographs, we couldn't find that photographer, but we knew it was a big time photographer in Paris. So they ultimately said, we can't use that painting. So I had to redo one. And this one, it's funny that you like that because it's my least favorite one.
Oh, really?
The whole book, yeah.
Why is it your least favorite? Is it just?
Because I was so in love with the original one. It was, I think, my favorite painting out of all the whole thing, because it had such a interesting look and feel to it with the white. She was like, it's almost pure white against the black contrast. Her neck was super long. It was like like a giraffe almost. Mm. And this one just didn't meet the standards that I like. But I mean, I appreciate that people like it, and I think it's not horrible, but it's just not one of my favorite ones.
Yeah. What is one of your favorites? Can you point to one?
Sure.
As being your biggest favorite?
Well, I like the Humphrey Bogart one in the Lauren Bacall, because that's a good story that goes with him. I did a movie with Lauren Bacall later in her life, and she had a very raspy voice because she smoked cigarettes. During the breaks in between scenes, she would tell me stories about Humphrey Bogart because they used to be married. He was a lot older than her. And she told me how they had a big argument one day, and because he wasn't washing the dishes like he said he would or something like that. It was a heated argument, and he left the house and he slammed the door and was gone for like 2 days. And she started to worry about him and worried and worried and worried. And finally, she got a phone call from him asking if she could pick him up down by Long Beach on the Pacific Coast Highway, which is maybe an hour from their home. So she went down there. She drove down there. She was going down Pacific Coast Highway. And in the distance, she saw him walking toward her on the side of the PCH, holding a single stem rose and just looking tired. And and I could just visualize that. So I drew a picture of Humphrey Bogart and then another picture of him walking down the side of the PCH holding a rose with the sun rising behind him. Mm. And so that's why I like that story. And another story she told me was that when Humphrey Bogart was sick with cancer, he was very frail. He lost a ton of weight. And their bedroom was upstairs. And whenever guests came over for dinner, he insisted on being stuffed into the dumbwaiter, which in the day was like a little waiter with a pulley that you pulled food up and down. It's not big enough for a person to ride up, but because he had become so small in stature, they would put him in there and they would lower him down and he'd come out of the door down in the lobby and meet his guests.
I'm not very tall either. Next time I'll come on stilts, wear a white tie and carry a tennis racket.
I doubt if even that would help.
You have a great caricature of the late, great Chris Farley. And you two worked together, of course, on Saturday Night Live for 5 years. What do you remember most about working with Chris?
Well, aside from his talent, I noticed how much he wanted to be liked and to get the laughs. You know, he was always trying to be funny. And it was, in a way, it was unfortunate that he couldn't just relax and realize that he was enough on his own. He didn't have to constantly get approval. And also, you know, he was a train wreck, and it wasn't a surprise what happened to him. In fact, he wanted to be just like John Belushi, because he's from Chicago. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, he did become just like Belushi. They both died at 33.
Yeah, yeah. Tragic losses, both of those. Yeah. And Chris Farley was the only person who ever came close to making you break character on SNL.
Yeah, right? Yeah. And that famous Chippendale dancer sketch, you know, where he was auditioning to be a Chippendale dancer against Patrick Swayze.
Barney, we all agreed that your dancing was great. Your presentation was very sexy. I guess in the end, we all thought that Adrian's body was just much, much better than yours.
And I'm telling you, I've never broke character in that show, except this one time. I almost did, but I didn't. Every time I looked up from the clipboard to see him dancing, I mean, the belly sloshing around and the stretch marks, I just had to keep looking down at my clipboard. I mean, it was so challenging to get through that sketch.
But you did it, so well done, yeah. Yeah, you're a big Howard Stern fan, so it's no surprise that your caricature of him is so great. It's fantastic. And I think it might be the most compelling caricature of all in the book. And you say that about 8 years ago, you finally faced your fears by letting Howard interview you. How did that go?
It went great. I mean, when I turned 60, I thought, you know what? I'm going to start facing my fears, whatever it is. And I'm going to start doing the things I've always talked about doing, including caricatures and taking Spanish and learning how to play the piano, a lot of things like that. And another one of my things was facing my fears. And one was doing the Howard Stern show and the Bill Maher show, real time. Well, first of all, because Howard Stern used to make fun of all the actors on Saturday Night Live. And I listened to his interviews, and he would always kind of put the guest on the spot. And a lot of times people would badmouth other people without meaning to, but because it was just the moment. It's like Norm Macdonald said, he didn't want to do that show anymore because too many people were getting mad at him for badmouthing them unintentionally. So then I noticed that Howard Stern's interviewing technique changed over the years. He seemed to be a little more relaxed and not so... Yeah, he had much more confident and secure in himself, I think. And so, you know, I went on there and I was prepared for any kind of question, but he was very respectful and we had a great interview and, you know, we got laughs and I was floating on cloud nine after that.
Yeah. There was one question, though, that he did ask you that was kind of like in his old style of interviewing, right? Can you tell us about that and how you responded to it?
If it's the one you're referring to, because it was the only one you were talking about. Me dating Jan Hooks on the show, which I did. We had been friends for 6 years before that show, and then we became romantic a year before it, and then we were dating on the show. And he asked me if I had ever gotten into Jan Hooks' pants. And I said, yes, I did. And they were very, very tight on me.
That's great. That's what a great comeback. Have you ever thought about combining your comedic talents with your drawing skills to create your own animated series?
I have thought about that. I've thought about that a lot when I've been seeing all these, you know, animated shows like The Simpsons and Big Mouth, all those shows. And I don't know. It just seems like you need to have a certain kind of a character in mind to do those. And, you know, I'm just doing characters on the face mostly, not even the bodies except for the Joker. I think there was somebody else in the book, but that would be great. Yeah, I'd like to do that.
Yeah, and well, you should be. Kevin Nealon, thank you very much for joining us today. Congratulations on I Exaggerate My Brushes with Fame.
Thank you, man. Thanks for having me. It's just fun.
Kevin Nealon is a comedian, actor, and a caricature artist. He's the author of I Exaggerate My Brushes with Fame. You can find out more about Kevin and his art at wpr.org/beta.
So the control stick where you can move your character around completely in three-dimensional space was really revolutionary at the time when games like Super Mario 64 or Mario Kart 64 came out.
Coming up, Elise Knorr joins us for a shaken, not stirred conversation about the James Bond video game GoldenEye 007. I'm Gordon, Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Public Radio, Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. If you recognize that music, you know what we're going to talk about next.
In 1997, a video game called GoldenEye 007 debuted on the new Nintendo 64. It was based on the latest James Bond movie, GoldenEye, which was released in 1995. And you may ask yourself, David Byrne style, wouldn't it make more sense to have the video game based on the movie come out at the same time as the movie? And you would be right to ask yourself this very pertinent question. But as it turned out, it didn't matter. The game was a huge hit, and it ended up breathing new life into the James Bond franchise and the video game genre. Elise Knorr is an associate professor of English at Regis University. She's also the author of GoldenEye 007, part of the Boss Fight book series on iconic video games. Elise's book tells the incredible story of how a team of rookie developers helped a British game studio develop one of the most revolutionary video games ever.
The studio that took it on sort of didn't want to take it on at first. So Rare, a little British game developer studio in the middle of nowhere, Twycross, England, sort of wanted to turn down Nintendo's offer to give them the game and to develop it. They were afraid that it wouldn't go very well because games made in response to movies or games that followed the plot of the movies tended to be notoriously bad. And so they just didn't want to bother with it. So then when a young developer named Martin Hollis convinced them to take it on, they sort of gave the project to him. It was his first project lead that he worked on. And his team was a bunch of guys who had never worked on a game before ever. So they were underdogs and nobody really expected much out of them. They were just sort of giving them a project to cut their teeth on, and it ended up being one of the greatest first-person shooters of all time.
Yeah, for sure. What was so innovative about GoldenEye at the time it was created?
Well, for one thing, first-person shooters were really a PC-only genre at that point. Games like Wolfenstein or Doom were really popular first-person shooters, but they were all for PCs. And PC gamers tended to be a little bit more hardcore. You know, to have a PC in your house was a bigger deal, a little bit more unusual. Whereas console gamers were a little bit more, you know, just there for fun. Just the fact that it was a console first-person shooter was a big deal. And then the things about it that design-wise made it kind of stand out. One is that the game was sort of designed backwards in the sense that the team developed spaces and levels before they had developed objectives for the player to complete in those levels. So what you had was a bunch of random hallways and rooms in certain levels that you didn't really need to go down to get anything or do anything in the mission. But they were there just because it made the space feel more realistic. It made it feel like an actual bunker or an actual missile silo. So things felt very realistic. They thought, wouldn't it be fun to be able to feel like James Bond and really take out Russian guards from all the way across the dam or all the way across the other space of the level? So they added in a sniper rifle. They added in motion capture, where when you shoot an enemy in a certain part of their body, they wince in pain and sort of grab that part of their body. And that involved one of the members of the team, one of the artists on the team, actually putting on a motion capture suit and going into the studio and having his colleague punch him in different parts of his body while he was blindfolded. So they really gave their all to make this game. The multiplayer was a very new thing, right? So being able to compete against three of your friends using the Nintendo 64's 4 controller port capabilities, that was very new and is a big reason the game ended up being so popular. Also, just the amount of humor, I think, was really innovative. At that time, games like Castle Wolfenstein and Doom, those first-person shooters, were really dark and gory and grim and serious, and you're kind of trolling around in dungeons, battling monsters. In GoldenEye, there was a real sense of humor. There was some really funny, silly things, sort of irreverent things. You can turn on big head feature in multiplayer, and all your players have big heads, or you can shoot paintballs. You know, everything explodes when you shoot it. Even tables and chairs burst into flames when you shoot them. So they definitely kept a sense of humor, which was pretty unique for the time too.
Definitely. One of the things that I was intrigued about, one of the features in the game was the watch, like that James Bond, you know, when you're playing the game, you're James Bond, and there's this feature where you would occasionally look down at your watch. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so in the attempts to make the player really feel immersed in that first person perspective, they thought, wouldn't it be fun if the pause screen, when you hit pause, is you looking down into your watch? And James Bond has this famous watch full of gadgets, especially in GoldenEye the movie. And so at other times in the game, it's not just a pause screen, it's also a tool. It has a magnet feature that you use to escape from a prison cell at some point by sort of magnetically attracting the key to the cell. It has a laser attached to it that helps you escape a welded shut train door. So it really makes you feel like James Bond, that you get to play with all of these gadgets. There's different data devices to sort of steal covert digital information. There's a camera. So they really wanted you to feel not just like you're doing a first-person shooter where you have to run and gun, but also that you have to collect information and sneak around stealthily and use all the tools at your disposal, including your very cool James Bond watch.
Mm, yeah. GoldenEye was created specifically for Nintendo's new N64 console. What impact did this console, the N64, have on how the game was created?
Well, when the team started developing the game, there was no N64 yet. So for a lot of development, they had no idea what they were working toward in terms of the N64's hardware capabilities. They didn't know what the controller would look like. They didn't know how fast the graphics would run or how much storage space they would have for graphics. They were sort of just getting updates from Nintendo on what aspirationally they were going to come up with, and then they adapted as they went. The N64 came out famously late. That sort of threw a wrench in everything for many different game developers. But at the end of the day, what really changed how GoldenEye works is the N64's single analog control stick. The control stick where you can move your character around completely in three-dimensional space was really revolutionary at the time when games like Super Mario 64 or Mario Kart 64 came out. The GoldenEye development team was playing those games and saying, wow, this is amazing. We should make a fully three-dimensional game. They had originally intended for the game to be on the rails, where you're kind of directed through the game automatically. You don't get to move around freely. All you get to move around is kind of arcade style is the gun. But once they saw what the N64 was capable of and how fun it was to move a character through 3D space, they were inspired to take the game off the rails and allow players to move the character all around the level and explore and get lost and sneak up on people and all of those fun things we love about the game.
Mm-hmm. The game is known as a breakthrough for its lifelike recreations of scenes from the GoldenEye movie. How did they accomplish that?
They accomplished that because very early on in their process, they had complete access to the film studio where GoldenEye the movie was being shot. So they went as a team into the film studio. They walked around the sets. They even picked up little souvenirs like baked glass and some fake ammunition cartridges. They gawked at Pierce Brosnan walking through the canteen. So they all got a kick out of that. And while they were on that trip to the studio, they took photos on a very early, very enormous digital camera, took those back to their studio campus at Rare and scanned them in. So a lot of the textures in the game, like on the walls or the floor of the different level spaces, are literally photos from the film set. Boris's shirt, some of us might remember how ugly his horrible shirt is. That was just a photograph in the costume wardrobe department of the actual actor's shirt that they scanned in. They also were provided with early scripts. They were provided with lots of photos and images of the weapons. So they put all that directly into the game, making it incredibly realistic for its time.
What was the public's reaction to the game?
It was a slow burn. There wasn't a huge, huge burst of sales early on, as there are with some games. But Ken Lobb, who the gun Claw is named after in the game, he made a really clever decision to make a deal with Blockbuster that they would all stock the game, and if they had any problems with it, they could send it back free of charge. And it ended up being rented. It had one of the highest rental rates of a game at the time. So people were renting it, falling in love with it, seeing how fun it was, multiplayer especially, and then going out and buying it. So it sold slowly and steadily. And then it kind of caught on as a cult phenomenon. Everyone was playing it at each other's houses. It was a real social game. People loved just having, you know, in high school, college sleepovers. It really became a cult classic for playing on your couch with your buddies, with the pizza, and just kind of having a hilarious good time. And so it took off slowly as word of mouth caught on. It came out right around the time that the N64 did. So there was a lot of excitement around that and the N64's multiplayer capabilities, which didn't hurt.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I found so intriguing about the multiplayer mode is that they had the Rare Studio guys team had a license to use any Bond. So you could have all the Bonds. You could have Sean Connery, George Lazenby, Roger Moore, everyone, Timothy Dalton. And also they had characters from that weren't in GoldenEye, like the iconic character Oddjob from Goldfinger and also Jaws. Yeah. How much of a part did that play in the fun of playing in the multiplayer mode.
Well, yes, they ended up with this extraordinary license that no Bond game would ever again have a license this all-encompassing. And again, Brett Jones, this huge James Bond fan on the team, went to town with it. He was like, I know that this game is about GoldenEye the movie, but what if we had a mission with Moonraker? You know, and what if we had a mission where you got to meet Jaws? Some of these iconic Bond villains from other movies. And so, you know, he went to town and added all these characters into the multiplayer, and it made it really fun. Someone like me growing up, I was 10 when the game came out, and I hadn't seen a single James Bond movie ever, but it was still so fun because everybody looks different. There's these dastardly villains with weird teeth and this short man, Oddjob, who's, you know, nobody really understands if you haven't seen the movies why he's so short. So it was just a lot of fun to have all that variety. And then just before the game was about to ship out, MGM Studios kind of stepped in and said no to the multiple Bonds. And that was just because all of those movie stars, you know, Timothy Dalton, Sean Connery especially, I believe, wanted to be paid royalties for that. And it just would have bankrupted the whole project. So they did have to remove those Bonds, but the Bonds remain in the original code for the game. And so there is someone out there who has made their own mod of GoldenEye called Goldfinger, where you do play as the Sean Connery Bond.
Oh, cool. That must be a lot of fun.
It's very fun. You can download it and play it on any PC.
How does the success of the GoldenEye game compare to the success of the movie?
GoldenEye game was much more successful. I mean, in different ways. So in terms of just pure sales, GoldenEye the game was more successful. But what GoldenEye the film did that was very important was it revitalized the Bond franchise. At the time that GoldenEye came out, there had been a very long gap between Bond films, between the last Bond film, which had starred Timothy Dalton, and GoldenEye, the longest gap in the Bond film franchise history. Timothy Dalton had been a really unpopular Bond and had kind of killed interest in the franchise. And also, the franchise was originally very much about the Cold War and, right, it was like very 1960s phenomenon. And so GoldenEye the film had the mission of revitalizing the franchise and showing why it was still fun and relevant for the 1990s. And so it was a tall order. And it was, you know, it was the first Bond with Pierce Brosnan. It was the first Bond with Judi Dench in the role of M. And so it was a really, really important film. And I think that the fact that we still have Bond movies today shows that GoldenEye, the film, was successful in doing what it needed to do.
Mm-hmm. Very well said. One of the things that shocked me was in terms of how much better the game sold, like how much more profitable it was than the film. Was just the game sold more than 8 million copies and earned $250 million worldwide, which was nearly double what the film made. That's like, that's really hard to believe.
Yeah. And if you talk to a lot of gamers from this era, they'll tell you that they played the game before they ever saw the movie. In my case, really wild story. I hadn't ever seen the movie until I started working on this book. I had played the game my whole childhood, but I had never even bothered to see the movie. I mean, in many ways, the story of the movie is told in the game. I also think that the original Austin Powers is really spoofing the entire Bond franchise, but in particular, it's spoofing GoldenEye the movie. And this anxiety around, is Bond, is this womanizing 1960s kind of figure going to still be relevant in what the media kept calling the politically correct 90s?
Mr. Powers, my job is to acclimatize you to the 90s. You know, a lot's changed since 1967.
No doubt, love, but as long as people are still having promiscuous sex with many anonymous partners without protection, while at the same time experimenting with mind-expanding drugs in a consequence-free environment, I'll be sound as a pound.
And so Austin Powers certainly plays that up with that character.
Yeah, definitely. What is the legacy of the GoldenEye game?
I think that the legacy of the GoldenEye game is that it brought first-person shooter gaming to an entire generation of gamers who were playing games only on consoles at the time. And for that reason, I see GoldenEye as the direct ancestor of Call of Duty, Halo, Fortnite, all of these first-person shooters today. I think they owe GoldenEye their popularity and their success in some way. GoldenEye is the first game to bring that genre to the console.
And all these years later, GoldenEye still holds up?
It does. I mean, it's very difficult to play the game if you have been playing first-person shooters of the last 15 years or so, because you're used to having two control sticks. You're used to have one control for your movement and one control for your aim. And GoldenEye forces you, if you're playing it on the original N64, to kind of retrain your fingers to do things very, very differently, which can be hard. But now that it is being re-released, we just found out, I think that a new generation of players is going to get to encounter this game and play it with a certain, dexterity that their own hands are used to and grew up on devices that maybe make the game controls more fluid. But I do expect that it's going to have a huge resurgence of popularity once it's re-released.
That was Elise Knorr. She is the author of GoldenEye 007. Find out more at WPR.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, George Saunders, Kevin Nealon, and Elise Knorr. Beta is available to follow on Spotify or wherever you catch your favorite pods. Don't forget to offer a rating or to share with new alphas. And you can keep up with us during the week online at WPR.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic.
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
I'm not a part of this cast, Overrated. I don't even know these people.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
I have no connection whatsoever with this show anymore, lawsuits, in fact.
And thanks to you, our alphas. More Beta comes your way next week. Until then, I'm Doug Gordon.
I'm off doing bigger and better things now, Hollywood Squares. I guess you could say...